said what you're not supposed to say because the people in power don't want to hear it. And I love that.
I have to celebrate you, baby.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. It'd be paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth, telling where we're gonna plant our seed, it makes me wanna cry. For the children, makes me wanna cry.
We could do, there's so much we could know if we listen to the earth.
Welcome. Glad you can join us for Ecologic. Clean air and water are healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. This is Ecologic for Wednesday, December 27th, 2023. Happy Kwanzaa.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Ecologic has a different format this week. Cycles of Nature is a discussion with a unique and accomplished human, Alexei Kondratiev. This interview never gets dated. Enjoy.
No one who met Alexei ever forgot him. He was revered. He was on many different WBAI shows over the years. Today's show was Alexei's last live appearance on WBAI.
Today's show is on natural cycles and their role in religion and religion's role in environmentalism. So we're combining a lot of things. And my guest today is Alexei Kondratiev.
Good morning.
And Alexei is a very multifaceted person. Besides speaking over 60 languages, which always makes people's eyebrows raise, he's also a nonfiction author. He wrote The Apple Branch. He's a fiction author, Vitterix the Druid, not available, but you can find it on eBay. He's a teacher. He teaches Irish language, Celtic mythology, and Celtic Christianity at the Irish Arts Center in Manhattan, and he's an active member of the Mythopoeic Society. And we're at the end of a yearly holiday cycle for many religions. And that reminds us there is a natural cycle of transformation in our environment that affects human beings and yet human beings affect. Nature-based religions train people to be mindful of this situation and to participate in it in an enlightened, non-harmful way. What do you mean?
Well, I'm going back to a study by an anthropologist named Evie Anderson, who wrote a book a number of years ago that was called Ecologies of the Heart, in which he showed how certain traditional societies, that is, low-tech societies mostly, that require living very close to nature in order to sustain themselves, have to work with nature, so to speak, in order to survive. And how they learn to do this is not through some rational cost-benefit analysis, you know, something that comes from scientific data, let's say, but through an emotional identification with their environment and a belief system that sacralizes this relationship, that makes it into something holy and sacred that they feel bound by and feel emotionally attached to.
So nature gives life, and life gives that sort of affection and sacredness for nature.
Yes, but it's also encoded in their culture, in their in what they learn about the world.
Give us an example.
Well, for instance, the belief that the ancestors go back to the land, and that being faithful to the land is being faithful to your ancestors, or being aware of your environment in the sense of the plants and animals that live there, and feeling that you owe a duty to those plants and animals because they're the ones that give you food.
Duty meaning?
Duty?
Yeah. And when you say duty, you mean you have to do something for them?
Yes, or? You have to do something for them so that they continue to survive, because this relationship has to be a permanent one for you to survive. So rather than say, you know, rationally, this is what I need to do to survive, they say, well, we do this because that's the way we've always done it. That's how the way we feel. We don't want to destroy our environment because we love it.
Yeah, you told a great story about Mayans.
Oh, yes. In that book, actually, there's an anecdote that's told about how Mayan families teach their children to be respectful of all life. And they teach their children that if you kill something, you have to eat it. There's no other reason to kill anything unless you have to feed on it. So a little kid who sees a brightly colored butterfly, most brightly colored butterflies taste horrible. That's why they're brightly colored, to warn predators away from them. So he kills the butterfly, and the mother forces him to eat the butterfly, even though it tastes absolutely horrible. So that imprints on the child, you know. I'm not going to kill anything that I don't have, that I don't want to eat.
That's quite a lesson. Is it a true story or is it a fable?
No, it's a true story. It's something that he observed.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
In terms of his research, yes.
And now, relate the season. Here we are at the end of the year, end of the secular year, but we're also in holiday seasons for lots and lots of different religions.
Yes, well, it's a kind of pause period in the cycle of the year, because humans are dependent on the growth cycle of nature, obviously. And there comes a time where nature rests, and you have to respect that rest, so to speak.
Hmm.
And it's like starting again. You go back to the origin of the cycle, to the resting point, and then it's going to start growing again. So you celebrate the return of this growth. And human beings don't feel comfortable in a lot of darkness because they're mostly sight-oriented. So when they can't see things, they feel uncomfortable. So a period of great darkness tends to limit your activities. And, of course, you need the darkness, too. A lot of people can't sleep unless they have some darkness.
And they show that sleep cycles are better in darkness.
Of course, yes. So the idea is that the land has to sleep at this time like a human being. And you respect that sleep, that period of rest.
Sure.
But then you celebrate the return of the growth as the sun cycle starts. The days start getting longer. It's already sensible right now, right? The sun was up much earlier this morning than it was on the solstice.
The solstice last week.
Yes. So we can feel this return of light, and that's what people celebrate. They're there in the heart of the darkness, but they know it's not going to get any worse.
You know? And yet it's the beginning of winter. I mean, it's going to be
colder
for a
couple of
months.
Well, it's not the beginning of winter in most traditional societies. This is just a shorthand that I think was invented in the 19th century.
Oh.
Because, I mean, it's called midwinter this season. It's not called the beginning of winter normally. The solstice is the middle of winter. It's the darkest part of winter.
Well, we don't think, I mean, we think of the weather changing, you know, in the fall and getting colder and colder. And this is sort of the beginning of the very coldest part. I mean, January and February is the coldest part.
Yes,
and that's
but the light is returning.
In many places,
and that's what matters to people, is that the light is returning, and that is what eventually is going to bring the...
So the light is more important than the weather, than the climate.
Yes, in many ways, yes.
And certainly many religions show this,
mm-hmm.
and nature-based people show this a lot as well. Mm-hmm. So what happened that... I mean, is it technology alone responsible for our being sort of divorced from nature and natural cycles?
I think to a large extent, yes. I think it's technology and capitalism working in tandem. That is, technology is something that we've had since the beginning because we need to protect ourselves from the elements. We need to find tools for survival. So technology has helped us in that, but it's helped us to the
you're
point.
You're going all the way back to when like people were making their own clothes.
Yes, exactly, which was not very long ago, which is still the case in many countries that haven't been touched by American style capitalism yet, and market economies and money economies. And the trying to get back to my original point.
technology.
Yes, technology. That now we've reached the point where we can insulate ourselves so much from natural processes that we have the illusion that we're separate from them, that we no longer depend on them.
Right.
So you get people who are completely in an urban environment who, you know, don't have to feel that it's cold out necessarily, don't have to, you know, can stay inside when it's raining at any time. I mean, they don't have to actually experience the weather, so to speak. They don't have to even be aware of things growing. A lot of people have the sense that water comes out of a tap and food appears magically in a supermarket. And the only concern is the price of the food, right? But not where it comes from or how it's produced. You know, that there are some people in charge who will take care of that. But that it doesn't really have anything to do with you and doesn't have anything to do with the environment, so to speak.
Right, either directly or indirectly, it grew somewhere.
Yeah.
And somebody was responsible for helping it
grow. Or even not aware that it grew or that it needs to grow, you know, just that it's there. It's there. It's prepackaged. It's ready to be consumed, and that's it. And a lot of people grow up feeling that way, even if they know better intellectually. They don't have this gut sense that, you know, this food has to be produced out of the land. It's a product of natural cycles, and we can't escape that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, you know, there's always the pictures of, like a picture of on a can of tomato sauce, you often see a picture of a tomato. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how many people relate that picture to what's inside and to an actual tomato that you could grow anywhere in the U.S., really.
True, except that, again, a tomato is something that is at least familiar to most people. Most people in a grocery store see a tomato. A lot of people might not be aware, you know, or don't really feel emotionally that a joint of meat came from a living animal.
And we don't even name it with the name of the animal unless it's a bird. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't eat cow, we eat beef.
Right.
You know, we don't eat pig, we eat pork. But we do eat chicken and we do eat whatever the name of the fish is.
Right.
So we divorce ourselves from some aspects of the animal dying, but not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the case of, you know, well, we're mammals too, and
well, actually, the reason for the change of name was simply that these were more important animals that had to be in England in the Middle Ages. These were animals that were raised to be paid as a tax, as a kind of rent. To landlords, to the people who actually owned the land. And so the landlord spoke French, and so the peasants spoke English, and so they called the animal by the English name while it was alive. And then once it was dead and it was being offered to the landlords, they used the French name.
So that's where beef comes from.
Yes, bœuf, right?
Uh-huh.
It means ox in French, right? Pork, porc, right?
So all because of taxes.
Rent, actually, yeah.
Now, lifestyles are different in different nations, but there's still a natural cycle everywhere. Mm-hmm. And yet it's not reflected, you know, for example, in the U.S., we use twice as much energy per person as they do in anywhere in Europe, and 10 times as much as anywhere in Africa, and 5 to 10 times more than in Asia. I would think that use of energy, of course, we're talking more and more technological countries, and yet the U.S. is so much different than Europe.
Well, I think it started much earlier in that sense. First of all, the U.S. is much larger. It's much bigger than any natural country was before the U.S. came into existence. You know, Russia was the only thing, the Russian Empire was the only thing that came close.
Not China?
China isn't that enormous in terms of...
It's bigger than the U.S.
Yes, it is, yes. Yeah. But, I mean, even China is bigger now than it was, you know, a few centuries ago. But the U.S. is the one that developed a capitalist economy on a territory that large, which required using an enormous amount of energy and transports, you know, using certain areas that specialized in producing certain things and then having to send that to the markets. So that requires an enormous amount of energy use.
Well, in Europe, countries trade with each other.
Yes, but it's on a much smaller scale.
So it's the scale, because, I mean, Europe has a denser population than the U.S. also.
Yes. Well, that means that...
Which I guess is part of the reason that they're more... they don't use as much energy per person,
yes,
because they're in more densely populated.
Yes.
I mean, New York City is the most energy-efficient part of the U.S., and we're the most densely populated.
Right.
So where does the natural cycle fit in with from country to country?
Well, I think the natural cycle is similar in most countries. The point is how much people actually
relate the northern countries
in their economic decision-making. For instance, we are used to getting anything we want at any time of year we want it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have people growing fruit in the southern hemisphere so that we can have it in winter. here, and the transport, again, uses up an enormous amount of energy. So originally, I mean, when you were living off the natural cycle, as people did until, you know, certainly 150 years ago, just about everywhere, you know that certain things come in season, and that you're not going to eat cherries until summer comes. And, you know, and you wait for that, and you don't expect to eat an enormous amount of food that comes from somewhere else.
And you preserve things.
And you preserve things, right.
You know, you have a little extra cherries so that you can have them in the winter, but they'd be preserved. They're not fresh.
Exactly.
They're not coming from Chile or
jams
whatever.
Or compotes of some sort. Yeah, that's right. And that's how you deal with it. And the same thing with animals, right? Animals are slaughtered at a certain time of year, and then you will preserve them also. You will smoke them or whatever and have that over a period of time, usually in the winter.
I hope people weren't imagining smoking an animal as like a cigarette. Again, we're so divorced from how meats are prepared. I don't think people realize that they actually use smoke from a fire to preserve meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of, again, it comes from a can. It comes from a package, the frozen food section, whatever. It doesn't come from the animal or the plant or even the truck.
Yes. Of course, traditionally, you used to slaughter your own animals, which meant that it was a certain amount of investment of your own feeling, you know. I mean, animals, after all, are not that different from humans. They behave similarly. They react similarly to certain circumstances. If anyone has ever, you know, been to a place where you kill a pig, you realize that the pig is perfectly aware of what's going on and is frightened. Mm. And it's not that different from killing a human. It requires a certain amount of emotional preparation in order to do something like that. And so people were more aware of the sacrifice of the animal made. And it, in fact, when I was growing up in the country, I mean, it was called a sacrifice. That was the word that was used in French for slaughtering anything. It was a sacrifice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how long? Well, when you were growing up in the country. So that wasn't that long ago.
No.
We're not talking 150 years.
No, we're talking about 40 years ago, yes. So there was an awareness of what was involved.
And you're right, and that awareness is gone. I mean, when you listen to the old-time radio shows that Max Schmid plays on Sunday nights here, you definitely get a feeling that the people who were around in the 40s knew about animals and slaughtering and gardening and farming, and it was common knowledge.
Yes.
And so that...
Well, because a lot more of the population was rural.
Yeah, so a comedian or a writer could make a reference to farming that did not go over the heads of most of his audience as it would today. And you don't hear those references so much anymore. And a lot of farming cliches that we still use, we have no idea what they mean. You know, we know what the cliche means, but we don't know where it comes from because we're so cut off from our farming. There's a lot fewer farmers. There's a lot. The farms are, of course, much larger.
They're not really farms. They're basically factories outdoors.
Yeah. They use the word factory farming. Mm-hmm. It's the very term that's described both to making produce, whether it's vegetables or fruits, or whether it's slaughtering animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's a factory.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk about what it's like as sort of going by their life, not as a part of their life.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is the money economy, of course. It's the fact that this is not subsistence farming. This is farming for profit. Mm-hmm. You're going to sell the produce in order to get money so that you can buy the necessities for yourself. You're not actually going to live off your work.
Uh-huh.
And this is, again, something that was unknown throughout the world until mostly in the 19th century, to some in Europe and, you know, in the West, certainly by the 18th century, but elsewhere. Not by the 19th century or the 20th, for that matter. And that's that you have to get your necessities with money. You don't, you know, originally people would build their own furniture. They would even build their own houses. Sometimes with the help of the community, which was a natural thing, because people helped build your house, you would help build theirs eventually.
Many hands make light work.
Yeah. And crafts were often traded for produce of the land. So, you know, someone might make you furniture and not you, but then it was not money that changed hands. It was actually something that you...
You trade a pie for a chair.
Exactly, something like that. And so it was when the money economy was essentially imposed on everybody that attitudes started changing towards land and towards the produce of the land and towards work, for that matter.
So So you're saying very strongly that the money economy is what has divorced us from
absolutely.
From our air, from our water, from our land.
Yes, because now we think of things as what they're worth in terms of money, not as having intrinsic worth in themselves.
Not as something that somebody made that I know or somebody
made
who's very talented.
Or even something that is worthwhile simply because it exists. That's what makes it worthy. And I think this is where the spiritual part comes in. The respect for nature as something that is good because it exists in and of itself, and we're part of it. In a traditional society, a society that actually lives off the land and knows that it lives off the land, the natural order is seen as sacred simply because it's there, because you can't escape it.
Right.
And
you can't really stop a glacier from melting.
No, you can't. You can. You don't expect the glacier to melt, essentially, because the glacier is
touché,
there.
Right.
The glacier is there and has been there for generations. So it may, you know, gradually change shape or size or whatever, but you expect it to be there because it has always been there. And you see it as part of what is around you. That is, you know, you may get your water from the glacier.
Which in many places do, right?
And you expect it to be there, and you don't do anything to prevent the water from getting to you. Now, the point where things start changing is where you say, oh, well, that glacier has a lot of water in it, so let's melt the entire glacier and get all of that water now, and maybe sell it to people who don't have enough water, right? That's the attitude that changes. But again, if you have
And once the glacier's gone, you need to go make money someplace else.
Right. Well, that is if you're not even from there, right? If you just come in and decide to use that resource and then you've used up that resource, you go somewhere else. I mean,
that's how the countries are aware of this.
Yeah. And the United States, of course, was a pioneer in that because a lot of our problems with our attitude to land is the fact that this country was essentially built by real estate speculators. You know, who came in and they took the land away from the Indians or bought it extremely cheap. And then sold it in parcels to people coming in and made fortunes that way. And it was considered to be the main way you made money originally in the U.S. It was simply getting all this land that was there for the grabbing, so you didn't actually spend an enormous amount of money. You didn't invest that much to get it, but then you got an enormous amount simply by distributing it.
Actually, the expense of however many bullets it took to get the people off the land, you have the land to sell.
Yeah, even if you didn't even take bullets to some extent, you know, you sometimes actually got native people to fight each other off. You know, you paid some of them to attack the others and get them off the land or use land rights that they thought they had in order to push other people off.
Right, Connecticut using their indigenous people to kill the indigenous people in New York, and New York the politicians using that there, and it went all over the country.
Yes. Yes, it did.
Sort of mercenaries, except that the people who did the fighting ended up not benefiting, but losing out to everything.
Yes. Yeah, and then eventually were forced into the money economy themselves when it was something that was completely foreign to their traditions. In fact, when Indian Territory became Oklahoma, that was the whole plan, right? Was that the Cherokees and other tribes that had been moved to that area owned their land in common when they were settled there. And it was part of their own decisions who farmed what, you know, or settled where. And then it was decided that they had to be there as individuals, each owning their own little parcel of property, which they could buy and sell, and having to farm it for money.
Uh-huh.
So insisting that the Indians had to follow the basics of capitalist economy.
The dominant white culture.
Yeah.
And I guess that's still going on.
Well, it's going on in the third world now, of course, places like New Guinea, where you also had mostly communal economic structures, and people are being forced into the money economy, you know.
So that's a cultural imperialism.
Yes, it is.
Of the North on the South or invaders on indigenous people.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, is that related to religious imperialism in any way?
Well, yes and no. I mean, sometimes it's used that way. That is, you often have a lot of Protestant missionaries that claim that, you know, they represent the Western way, that Western capitalist economy, this kind of society, is what is most appropriate to Christianization. Of course, there's no reason why it should be. But in fact, if you take the gospel seriously, it's not. It's obviously quite the contradiction. But it has been presented that way in the past. I think less so now.
I remember you telling me a story about an area of Africa where bats were sacred, and these particular bats pollinated most of the food plants. So there's a very good reason for them to be sacred. And then the European missionaries came in and said, oh, no, no, bats are bad. Bats are bad. You must kill them.
Yeah, I don't know that they actually said bats are bad. They basically said bats are not sacred. There's no reason for any animal to be sacred.
And so suddenly the food crops weren't being pollinated. And of course, the European missionaries didn't know why, because bats are not as big pollinators in Europe as they are in any southern country. Mm-hmm. And so, again, divorcing people from their land and from the natural religion destroyed their health and life.
You're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Donna Stein.
And I'm Sally Gale. And I'm Ken Gale. Sorry, Sally.
No worries.
Ecologic covers every environmental issue. We help educate and activate our listeners. This makes your donation to us one-stop donating. We help many groups get the word out. When you become an Ecologic BAI buddy for just a few dollars each month, 10 or more, you become a sustaining member, which gives the station the support it needs.
You might have met that special someone in your life, a family member, a friend, a professor, a coach, a passing acquaintance that you will remember always and want to share with others. That is Alexei Kondratyev. Ken is pleased to share Alexei with you. WBAI gives us the opportunity to bring you exceptional bios and interviews that you won't find anywhere else. WBAI is listener-supported, and the way we can keep bringing you exceptional content like this is by your being a part of this station. Please ensure that Ecologic and WBAI can survive to tell these stories. Your support makes it happen.
Donating as a buddy is an easy way to make a bigger donation, spread out over a year, and it helps the station plan. Free Speech Radio depends on listener members to be part of the process. Your funding keeps us on the air. We rely on you, just as you rely on Ecologic to bring you the latest environmental news.
If you're making end-of-the-year donations, please consider WBAI. Donations are tax-deductible, and BAI is trying to clear as much debt off the books as possible to start the new year with a clean slate. With a donation of $35 or more, you can choose a gift from our premium selections. Go to give2wbai.org and search for Eco-Logic.
We have lots of premiums for you to choose from. And of course, even a one-time donation of any amount will help BAI pay our year-end bills, whether or not you select a premium. You can boast that you helped keep WBAI on the air. Get a membership in the name of a family member, no matter what their politics are.
Help keep BAI on the air, serving our communities. It's a great time to make a donation. These are the last few days to make an end-of-year tax-deductible donation. Your gift today will help you when taxes are due. And, of course, signing up as a BAI buddy makes donating an easy part of your monthly budget and helps the station with a regular source of income to pay our bills. You can visit WBAI.org and click the green BAI buddy sign with the peace dove and sign up through our safe, friendly portal with thanks from us at Ecologic and WBAI. Or call 212-209-2950 and say you want to be a BAI buddy for any amount in the name of Ecologic or all BAI shows. Or make that one-time end-of-year donation. Whatever works best for you is more than welcome and received with gratitude. Just a few minutes of your time lets us know that you value independent, progressive news, information, and entertainment, and keeps the lights on and the transmitter transmitting.
And if you want, you can send a check or money order for your membership and or premiums directly to WBAI. Mail to WBAI Radio, Attention Membership, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. That's 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, 11217. And here is Charlie Murphy singing his song, Light is Returning, a song that is timely for this time of year.
Ooh, 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 ooh.
Light
That was Charlie Murphy singing Light is Returning. You're listening to Ecologic, WBAI's premier environmental show, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Donna Stein.
And I'm Sally Gellert. Now we're back with Alexei Kondratiev.
There's another writer who's an anthropologist who writes about the environment, who's Gary Nabhan, who wrote a lot about the Tohono O'odham, the people that used to be called the Papago, who live in the area around Tucson in southern Arizona. And he wrote about them gradually losing their language and how the language is what kept their culture going. Language in general is what keeps a culture going.
Sure.
People who speak a certain language think in terms of that culture. The culture is encoded in the language, and that's how it's passed down, how the attitudes, the awareness elements in that culture, you know, what you're conscious of most of the time, gets passed down is through speaking a particular language. And so he said that the language, the O'odham language, made them see the world in a certain way, made them pay attention to certain things, and helped them know how to deal with their desert environment. And that as they stopped speaking it, as English started replacing their language, they were losing their ability to relate to their environment in the same way that they had. And he said that, for instance, in a European person, when he speaks of a desert, he thinks of that there's nothing there, that it's a place that's empty, and that to the O'odham, their environment is not empty. On the contrary, they refer to it as a shining place, and it's full of life to them. It's full of living things. And so once they lose the language that encodes all of those living things, that explains what they are and how they relate to each other, then they no longer see them. They're no longer aware of them. They start thinking, you know, like white people, essentially, that it's just this dry, empty place that's of no real worth. And he notes another thing is that they become conscious of being separate from white people entirely by their race and not by their culture.
Ah.
They start getting this kind of generic Native American identity, you know, where we're different because comic book ideas of Native Americans, you know, or New Age ideas.
Or movie ideas.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's what they identify with, and not with actually their own native transmitted culture, which can only be really accessed through their language.
So their culture is no longer an individual from that area of Arizona, but rather generic as to how the kids are taught how to act. If you're an Indian, therefore, you must act like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even that they're taught that way formally. It's just that this is what they pick up from the media, from their surroundings, you know, that this is who they're supposed to be.
And then there's a religious school will actually yank kids from their families and
yeah,
really
impose. Not even just religious schools. It was any schools. It was state schools. You know.
The Canadian government did that to the Pacific folks.
Yes, well, the U.S. government did that to everybody.
Yeah. And so because of that, the people who know this land and know this water and know what grows here best don't know their own land. And we're not going to know our land that we're living in for whatever reason we're living here. Mm-hmm. So is biological diversity related to cultural biodiversity?
That's what most people think
exactly.
Nowadays, yes.
Mm-hmm. We mean nowadays.
Cultural diversity is the ability to have your culture be associated with exactly where you're living, which is not like another place. We tend to try and make all places like each other. Mm-hmm. You know, you are on an American highway. You have the same chain food stores or whatever all over.
Every single exit has the same food. And,
exactly.
And if there is a local restaurant, it never makes it on the signs on the highway.
Yes, and you have these suburbs that all look exactly like each other. And so people change their living place with their employment, right? They say they live on the East Coast, and then their employer moves to the Midwest. So they move to the Midwest, and they buy a house that looks exactly like the house that they lived in on the East Coast. You know, the same trees, the same lawn, the same everything. And they feel like they haven't moved anywhere, really.
Yeah.
And it's designed for that, so that you can yank people around and put them wherever you want them to be. And they don't have any sense of place.
I remember an article in Natural History magazine many years ago where an anthropologist wrote about McDonald's the way you would write about any anthropological part of life and compared it to a religious experience, mm-hmm. where you expect certain things and you get certain things and nothing has changed no matter where you are. It's like you go to a church, and if you go to the same denomination, it's the same hymns, and they're done in the same order, and everything has a certain way that it's done, and it doesn't matter where you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's changed even more, I would say. I mean, even churches tend to be more enculturated now than American capitalist market society. You know, churches do have... they do adopt the languages of the places where they operate.
But if every place is the same...
Well, that's where it's going. It's going, yes. Every place is not the same yet. And the churches have not been going along necessarily with making every place the same.
So you feel that a church fits its environment more than any other aspect of life?
Not any other aspect of life, but certainly than the market economy does, yes.
Or the workplace.
Yeah.
You know, one office is kind of the same as another, which is why you can read a Dilbert cartoon and no matter where in America you live, mm-hmm. you get it.
Right, exactly.
You know, you've experienced those characters. Mm-hmm. Well, you have, you know, The Office, right? A successful American show. Mm-hmm. It was a successful British show because mm-hmm. offices are the same everywhere.
Exactly.
And so you've met all of those people in that TV show, and it's mm-hmm. the shared culture that we have. Boy, the time has gone by, and I forgot to reintroduce you or the show. I'm Ken Gale. The show is Ecologic. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And my guest is the ever-fascinating Alexei Kondratiev, who is the author of The Apple Branch, a nonfiction book about the Celtic view of life. He's the author of Vitus the Druid, which is fiction, a comic book based on Celtic culture. And he teaches the Irish language, Celtic mythology, and Celtic Christianity at the Irish Arts Center, and also an active member of the Mythopoeia Society and the Celtic League American branch, and quite the polyglot. We've been talking about the natural cycle and how right now, this time of year, a lot of religions are celebrating the natural cycle in ways that are remarkably similar to religions that themselves are not that similar. And, of course, light being the main aspect of all these different religions.
Mm-hmm.
Kwanzaa has light. Christianity has light. Judaism has light. Well, you can name more religions than I can that all deal with light at this time of year.
Well, again, like you said, it's pretty much a common theme. Any religious tradition that is grounded in the Northern Hemisphere, let's say, at least in, you know, Arctic or temperate areas, is very strongly aware of the light cycle. It affects people's lives.
And yet, the Hanukkah Festival of Lights had nothing to do with the solstice.
No. But that's how it became ingrained in tradition, is because it was around this time of year, and so it fit in with what was happening around. It sort of molded itself to the natural cycle.
And Christmas lights are a 19th century import from Germany, right?
Well, the lights, but not necessarily. The tree is.
The tree is.
The tree is, but, you know, it came out of Saturnalia, which was the feast of Saturn, mm-hmm. whose name actually means sowing, the one who impregnates, that is the one who's going to make things grow again.
So sowing is S-O-W, not S-E-W.
S-O-W, yes. And so it was the feast in honor of him. It was the return of the light again, you know, the feast of the sun, who was not conquered and therefore would grow again, even though it seemed to have been conquered by darkness. Hmm. It was not and returned. And it was a season of gift-giving and of lights. And Saturnus, of course, became Santa Claus. He became Father Christmas. Huh. Very, you know, in a sort of very smooth progression through late antiquity and the Middle Ages, he became Father Christmas.
So, now you consider yourself both a Christian and a pagan.
Yeah.
Which to, I would imagine, at least three quarters of the listeners, is a surprise that anybody can be both of those things at the same time.
Well, it's not, it should be natural. I mean, I think paganism, in the sense as it was even understood in the past, it's more or less natural religion. That is, religion that is not revealed, religion that is simply born out of the natural cycle and the human condition in nature, you know, how you relate spiritually to your environment. And Christianity is a revealed religion, a religion that is about the contact of God with people, a will's contact, an exchange that took place. And so it gives you different imperatives. It gives you something that can be added on to paganism, but that is not in contradiction with it at all.
Then where does the contradiction come from?
Contradiction only comes from church, I think. It comes from, it's essentially power play. I mean, that's how the contradiction appeared originally. That is, you have certain people who have the monopoly of religious activity in certain areas, and they don't like to be replaced by someone else.
So it's not coming from the people who are in the religion, but rather the people who run the religion, who
yes,
rule the religion.
Exactly. And it's coming from boundary problems, you know, this is where my authority starts and stops.
But people buy into it. I mean, you know, a lot of Christians will see something pagan and they automatically hate it no matter what it is, even if they haven't delved into it.
It's actually more the other way around.
And the other way around is very true.
Yeah.
Where a pagan will say, oh, you have to hate Christians because they hate us.
Yeah. Well, it's mostly because for centuries, Christian institutions have had so much authority in our society that people have felt oppressed by this authority. And so they look for any alternative. And paganism is one of a very attractive alternative to a lot of people. So they often use it as a religion that they use against their birth religion.
Right.
And they get the impression that everything that my birth religion believed, I no longer believe, and paganism can't possibly believe it because I've rejected it. In fact, there's a lot in common between any religious systems. But very often you tend to accentuate what is not compatible in order to create boundaries for yourself.
So let's bring it back to the environment in the last few minutes we have left. On how, should every pagan be a political activist or an environmental activist? Should every Christian be a political activist or an environmentalist?
Well, I think both could be. I think
could be or should be?
I think it should be in this day and age, certainly. And certainly paganism is a Western reflection of religions that follow the natural cycle. It's an attempt at being a nature religion, using Western traditions and Western ways of looking at things. And the experience of living in Europe, let's say, which is the ancestral homeland of most of the people here, right? Well, except for those, of course, who come from Africa or Asia, but that's more recent. But the culture is certainly European and defined. And so people who come from that background, and certainly speaking English, that sort of confers an European cultural identity on most people, regardless of where their ancestors are from, that gives them the resources to create a nature religion based on that cultural background. And so, yes, of course, it's based on the natural cycle. It's based on cooperating with the natural cycle, on feeling that you this is what sustains you. And so because it does that, it's good, it's holy, and you have to have an attitude of reverence towards it and follow it, cooperate with it. Now, there's no reason why this can't apply to Christianity as well. And I think a lot of Christians are aware of an environmental duty as well, and it's been actually made explicit in many churches, including Catholic Church. More recently.
Well, a lot of Christian churches have harvest festivals.
But Harvest Festival is not necessarily, that's thanking God for having been able to have a harvest and sustain.
Yeah, but that's still a, more of an acknowledgement of nature.
It is, yes. That you had to go through the natural cycle to produce it. But there's also more of an awareness of nature as being God's creation. And Genesis says that God created nature and it was good. It said explicitly. So that doesn't give people license to mess it up. You know, so the natural order as it was created before human beings is good. Now, humans have a right to, you know, grow themselves and make use of the natural creation, but they can't simply mess it up. They can't simply destroy the order that's there. They have to cooperate with it for their own good, for their own ability to survive, because they're part of this order. That
there is no moral right for this.
Yes. So there's definitely enough precedent for Christians to have this attitude as well and be environmental.
Any books you'd recommend to explore this further?
Well, I talked about A.V. Anderson's book, which is Ecologies of the Heart, is very good because it gives a sense of how several different cultures have adopted belief systems that help them relate to their natural environments.
So E.V. Anderson, E period, V period, or?
Yeah.
Anderson, Ecologies of the Heart. And then Starhawk.
Yeah, Starhawk is a pagan author who is about political activism, in particular environmental activism, but also social activism, community activism, peace activism.
And any book in particular? You'd, you know, if a listener was just learning about Starhawk, like right now, what would be the
first book? Well, I think the first book that she wrote, which was sort of the book that many people first read and got them interested in paganism, was The Spiral Dance. And that's gone through several editions, so...
So that's still in print.
Yeah, that's still in print.
I mean, I prefer Dreaming the Dark myself.
Yeah, Dreaming the Dark
is more political.
Yes,
it is. It's way more political.
Yeah. Dreaming the Dark is how to go beyond that into actual social activism, political activism.
Are there any, I mean, obvious that pagans would talk about environmentalism. It's not as obvious for Christians, but there must be books that connect.
There are books. I can't think of any offhand, but there's a movement that's called Green Cross. That's a Protestant movement, but that's environmentally conscious.
Green Cross.
Yes.
So I guess a nice internet search would find all kinds of things for Green Cross.
Right.
And of course, there's the greening a church and greening a synagogue movement to make more efficient use of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring that if you know how your church is saving money by using less energy, you can do it too.
Right.
And I should add that the greening a synagogue movement is many, probably a couple of years ahead of the greening a church movement at this point. There's a lot of groups out there connecting different, whatever their religion is, and environmentalism, despite the fact that you have representatives of government trying to say that, no, environment is bad for money. And of course, it's
well, because
it might be bad for a company, but it's not bad for your money because your expense is their profit.
Right.
So if you have less expenses, you know, it's good for you. But
yeah, but sometimes it takes more expense in order to right a situation so that later you save money.
Buying a solar panel now and then never having an electricity bill again or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are pretty much out of time, so I had better just tie things up. Alexei Kondratyev has been my guest. And if you want to do an internet search on him, it's his name is spelled Kondratiev. And I'm sure Alexei Kondratyev will put up a lot of internet searches if you look up your name, won't it? Oh, you never looked?
Not
there is a lot.
Wow.
That was a really cool interview. I really enjoyed listening to that.
Yeah, Donna and Sally have heard me talking about Alexei Kondratyev since they've known me, and neither of them had the benefit of meeting him in person. So, and of course, many of you haven't either, although I've been surprised at the people who we have in common that I didn't realize until we started publicizing this show.
Yeah, when we were doing the promotion, lots of people came by and commented that they knew Alexei and they're so glad we're doing the show. Your friend Patricia, what's her last name?
Oh, Pat Yarrow,
Pat Yarrow. Amy Bergenfeld, Dina Tlemsa, Talbot Katz, so many people.
Yeah, Gina Tlemsa plays the flute for the Ray Corona band. I didn't know she knew Alexei. But he touched so many lives, in so many different directions.
Time does fly, and it's time to go. So thanks for joining us. You can read more about Alexei Kondratiev on Ecologic's website, www.ecoradio.org. And of course, as Ken just said, you can Google him, or as we prefer, DuckDuckGo him. and we can, it's another, it's a better site. We have information on a wide variety of environmental issues there, and you can find links to our previous shows on many environmental issues. Look over the site, ecoradio.org. And if there's a show or news item for which you'd like a follow-up or a news report, there is a clickable link near the top of the page, just under the promo meme, to email us. And please go to give to WBAI.org to become a BAI buddy or choose a premium.
Join us next Wednesday, January 3rd at 10 a.m., our first show of the new year. We love to stay in touch with you. So those of you online, please sign up for our email list while you're checking out ecoradio.org. And those of you on Facebook, please like our page. We're at WBAI Ecologic, no dashes.
And on our ecoradio.org, you'll see how to spell Alexei's name. So if you didn't catch it when we said it before, just go to ecoradio.org. WBAI is listener-supported community radio, and there's lots of ways to get involved. And, of course, we always need your donations. We need your contributions to support everything that makes a broadcast happen, the engineers, electricity, equipment upkeep, rent. Pledging as a BAI buddy now during this show really helps Ecologic especially.
We are always glad to have you with us for Ecologic, live or on the archives. This show will be on the WBA archives in just 5 or 10 minutes.
Our thanks to our engineer, Sean Rhodes. We couldn't do this without you. Thank you a lot. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. Well, Sally, we've been talking over you all day.
yeah, but we talk over her when she says her name.
We're all Sally Gale today. And I'm Donna Stein. Join us next Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024. Oh, my God. We're into 2024. Yay.
Almost.
At 10 a.m. We're usually here Wednesdays at 10 a.m. between Covert Action Bulletin and Living for the City. But today, after Ecologic, there will be a special presentation, and Living for the City will be preempted just for today. Check our website for details. Thanks for being our listeners.
How bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
So solar power, inexpensive energy. So
Good morning. You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WPAI in New York. Ecologic with Ken Gale, Donna Stein, and Sally Gellert came to you live with portions on recording over listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York. Now, normally at 11 o'clock, you'd hear Living for the City with Michael G. Haskins. As the host just mentioned, that is not on this week. He'll be back next week. Instead, you'll hear a Christine Blasdale special. So please, stay tuned.
Hey, Maya, guess what? Kylie Jenner's new lip kit is out.
Mercedes, are you really going to spend your money on that garbage?
It's not garbage. She finally released a color I've been looking for, ginger.
Mercedes, you can do so much more.
Like what?
You can donate it to WBAI and become a BAI buddy.
What's a BAI buddy?
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a monthly donation to WBAI. Once you join, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a free tote bag. The BAI buddy card allows you to become eligible for on-air giveaways and receive discounts at local shops, museums, and venues. And that's not even the best part. You can get all of this and more by donating as little as $10 a month.
That sounds amazing. I want to become a BAI buddy. How can I join?
You can sign up at WBAI.org.
WBAI.org? Got it. Thanks. And you're right, I can do a lot more at WBAI than with Kylie Jenner.
It's all about supporting a medium that keeps it 100.
Extinction Diaries. There are 6 known freshwater dolphin species, all highly adaptive, yet 5 are in immediate danger of extinction. A 7th, known as the Baiji or Chinese Yangtze River dolphin, was declared extinct in 2006. 4 of the 6 remaining species and a few subspecies are in Asia, and 2 others are struggling in the Amazon. Pollution is weakening and killing these incredible freshwater cetaceans. For instance, mercury poisoning from Amazon gold mining is killing the pink bodu, and Chinese factory runoff was a major factor in the Baiji extinction. Damming rivers, increased agriculture, accidental entanglement, and overfishing the dolphins' food sources are also prime causes of depopulation. There may be only 950 Ganges River dolphins, as few as 150 Irrawaddy, and 1,000 or less of the Asian finless porpoise. The speed of species depopulation is mind-boggling. The Baiji went from 6,000 plus to 0 in 3 decades. We must act courageously to avoid that fate. My name is Arnold Oliveira. This is a Small World Radio production.
This is Ralph Pointer. Join me and others every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. It would appear the human movement is such that at any moment in history, there are too few that understand possibilities of existence that would benefit all who inhabit this planet and are willing to act on this understanding. This program will feature that few. What are your views on these issues that impact your life today? What are your views on America today? What are your views on America's future? Can we talk? Call in 212-209-2877. Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music, history, and social commentary, along with expert discussion of the important issues and events of today and yesteryear. So keep it locked into WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
I'm David Rothenberg. I joined up with WBAI not long after Marconi discovered the wireless. If you tune in on any Saturday, that's the name of my program, you'll hear some good music, commentary covering politics, theater, movies, books, and a word or two about the criminal justice system. Actually, it's whatever's on my mind. And there's